Good morning. We were in the middle of the chapter on objectivity. I just made some comments on knowledge as contextual, so we'll start by taking questions on that section, page 180 following. Yes.
Page 183, the third paragraph, metaphysically.
Yes.
I confess that I'm still floating on this, the first three sentences. It's really related to the words interconnected and affected and how you're using them.
Hod, in what sense do I mean interconnected? On 183, the third paragraph, metaphysically, there's only one universe. I'm using it extremely broadly. If you notice, I say every entity is related in some way to the others. I don't necessarily mean a direct relationship. I leave open the type of relationship. It could, for instance, be a direct causal relationship. Much more likely, in most cases, is a very indirect causal relationship. You know, it's been said by many people, not restricted to objectivism, that any one change redounds throughout the system, so that if you jostle one atom, and it jostles the next, etc., and that this is energy change in one form or another is communicated in continuous changes throughout the entire system. Now, of course, most of that is far beyond our perceptual ability, but we're here speaking of metaphysically. So one central meaning of this is causally, directly or indirectly, immediately or ultimately. Since it's one universe, everything has to in some way ultimately have an effect on other things. The other sense of interconnected here is the measurement sense. We hold that everything is knowable by the mind. Since consciousness is a faculty of grasping what is, there can't be something which by its nature is detached and unknown to consciousness. And knowledge is establishing relationships. Now, I'm not using this as a proof, but just as a sense of, in what sense I mean, interconnected. In coming to know something, we establish some kind of relationships, because that's the essence of what consciousness and knowledge consists of. Now, typically, our relationship on the conceptual level is in terms of measurement. So another aspect of this, that everything is related, is that everything is in some form measurable, relatable back to another unit. But now, that is an epistemological, whereas the aspect, the causality, would be the basic metaphysical one. But Ayn Rand used to make the point that if something were completely isolated, it would be a logical impossibility, because it would mean it's not part of the universe. It's something that it acts, but it has no relation, no impact, no connection to anything else. Well, then how could it be part of the universe and fail to be affected or to affect, fail to be relatable to? You see, on either count, it would have to be like two universes. And that, by definition, is a contradiction. Now, if you wanted me to work out the physics of this, I would have to make some really outrageous assumptions, which I don't want to do, which I think were suggested by Parmenides, but I really want to get away from that, and that's why my language is deliberately very generalized here. Yes?
Did you come to it from the law of identity applied to the universe, or do you have to...
You come to this conclusion from the fact that there is one reality, not more than one, and that that it's governed by identity and causality, but that if anything were not related to the rest, it would not be part of the universe, and you would have the contradiction of two different universes. That's basically it. But when we reach omniscience or closer to that, it'll have a lot more detailed content. Every time we integrate and make a connection between two things that we didn't before suspect, we are getting a clearer concretization of what it means to say everything is interconnected. Now, all you have to do to try to specify it is imagine you've reached the stage of cognition where you can connect everything to everything. Now, that's a tremendous amount of time from now, but still, you can project how far you've come from the time you started. Well, if you project that to the end and then mirror what the metaphysics underlying that, what the reality must be, that corresponds to this type of interconnection. That's concretely what we would mean. But of course, I don't mean to infer metaphysics from epistemology. It's the other way around. But as long you just want me to concretize what it would mean, that's a good point. Other questions on knowledge as contextual. And you remember what this is about? Basically, the knowledge being relational, the need to keep hold the context, and the various forms of being out of context, dropping context, compartmentalization. I'm just reminding you of some of the issues in here. Does anybody have any further questions on this section? Yes. Yeah.
Could you please clarify the second paragraph on page 181?
The second paragraph on page 181. Yes, that is the idea that concepts are a relational form of knowledge. It simply is illustrating the broad point that all knowledge is establishing relationships. This is true on the perceptual level. You have to discriminate certain sensations, differentiate them from the rest. That already is establishing a relationship, right? The difference between this and this. A relationship is two things considered together. And when we take a group of sensations and consider them in relation to the background and say, oh, there's a difference, that's establishing a relationship, a certain type. Now, when you put all the sensations together into a percept, when you integrate, you are establishing a relationship. In this case, of parts to a whole. You're putting them all together into a whole. So you could say perception is a thoroughly relational form of knowledge. You have to differentiate sensations and then integrate them. Now, all I'm doing is saying that the same is true of concepts, although the exact form of the differentiation and integration is not the same. But when you form a concept, as this, it goes on, we put things together because they're similar. Similar what? As against something else. For instance, two tables, if you just looked at them in a vacuum, you would never get the idea that they are similar. You would just look at them without any context, you see, without any relationship to anything else, without any contrasting background, and you'd see one is big, one is small, one is green, one is red, one is rough, one is smooth, one has five legs, one has one. So you just see this and this, two different objects. You see, the term in your mind standing for that awareness would be different, that's all. But when can you grasp similarity, which is essential to classification and concept formation? If and when I bring a chair in, and you say, ah, there's now, these two are like each other, if that's the thing we're differentiating it from, given chair as the background, then obviously these don't have back, the table doesn't have a back and the chair does, and the table doesn't have a seat and the chair does, you see? So you see there's a gross difference, and suddenly the two different tables become apparent to you as similar. Similar in a certain kind of shape as against the shape of a chair. But without the chair, without the contrasting background, you couldn't establish similarity. That's why Ms. Rand used to say that two is the minimum number of units to grasp difference, but three is the minimum number to grasp similarity. Two similars as against a different. And in that sense, all concept formation consists in grasping similarities, of grasping relationships, and then, of course, of putting them together, integrating them into a unit. But what the reason I'm stressing this here is that you can't form a concept in a void. Only against certain things, against a background of other things. And that becomes the context for the concept. These are the relationships on the basis of which you say, I'm going to single out these two tables and other things like them and make a new concept. And thereafter in your mind, it always has to stand as such and such as a table, parenthesis, subconsciously. And I mean that in contrast to chairs, beds and books, or whatever. And in fact, you even cover that in your genus by defining it as an article of furniture. And that one of the main functions of the genus is to bring the context back to you, remind you what are the broad class from which you're distinguishing this, what did you distinguish it from? Now that's exactly what Rawls did not do, you see, when he used the concept urn. We started using that as a relational form of knowledge, earning as against stagnating, let us say, or being a parasite. That was just like table versus chair, you see. We were able to form earning because we had this contrast that we were differentiating it from. He comes in now and applies it in a completely different situation where there is no longer any contrast because nobody is capable of earning anymore. So the original context is thrown out. The original distinction on the basis of which we could reach earning is thrown out, and it just becomes a sound detached from reality because he dropped the context. Now, I hope that makes it. Does that make it clear? That's the best I can do unless you're more specific. Anybody else? Yes.
Could you have switched the order of this section with the following one on knowledge is hierarchical?
That's a good question. I thought about that at some length, and I oscillated back and forth. Could you do knowledge as hierarchical first and knowledge as contextual second? I can't prove that you couldn't. The reason that I did this first, and the reason I think it's preferable, is one point. And that is that knowledge as hierarchical can be regarded as an aspect of knowledge as contextual. See, the broad principle is knowledge is relational. Everything is interconnected. You can't take any conclusion as an atom and a void. Now then, one concrete form of that is not only there's a whole surrounding context, but the context itself has steps. Some are closer to sense perception, some are farther removed. And therefore, when you want to connect the thing through its context to reality, you have to go through a series of hierarchical steps. And in that sense, it seemed to me more logical to take the broad principle of interrelatedness first, and then a specific type of relationship. I do have a section here where I relate the two, and that came straight from a discussion that I had with Ms. Rand on the bottom of 197. This is the clearest that I can explain it. The bottom paragraph there says, let me relate the issues of context and hierarchy. A hierarchy is a type of context. That is, all the earlier information in that graded series is the context for the next higher item, but it happens to be arranged structurally according to the distance from the perceptual level. So it's like a concrete under it. And the two take, these were basically Miss Rand's words that I tried to recreate here. On the next page, that's her summary. The principle of context takes an overview. It looks at the sum of knowledge already acquired and says it is a sum. The principle of hierarchy looks at the process by which a given item was learned, at the step-by-step going from the simpler to the more complex. So they complement each other, and you really couldn't do one without the other in the same thought unit, because you just had context, it would be too floating to know how to get back to reality. You first grasp that you have to keep all the relations, and then you go into specifically what type of relation brings you back to sense data, you see. So you could probably have done it the other way, but I think there's a logic to this way. That's a good question. Those are the questions I agonized over in the writing of it. Who else? Yes.
You mentioned in passing yesterday that you couldn't integrate a new item of knowledge with literally everything you already knew. How do you, can you say something about where you stop or how you know where to stop or what the principle is of the integration that you actually do?
Well, that is Professor Buechner is asking, I said you can't integrate an item actually with every single thing you know. So how do you know where to start or stop or how much to do and how to do it? That is a how-to question, which would really involve a whole course if I was capable of giving it and systematizing it. That would be an invaluable course in practical epistemology. And I, of course, got ideas on that subject, but I don't know how to condense briefly beyond saying a couple of pretty obvious points. First of all, it is contextual. That is, you cannot do more than your knowledge enables you to do. If you are, an early stage of knowledge, you can't be expected to integrate it on the scale that someone at a later stage would. So at each stage, you can only do what is possible to you within the framework of your knowledge. But then how do you know, even within the knowledge that you have, you can't literally connect a given idea to everything? You have to do it by means of knowing what is essential. If you file your concepts and your conclusions according to what is essential, that will be the guideline as to where to look to make interconnections. In other words, you do it basically through your definitions. As a crude beginning of an example, you hear egoism for the first time. You know, you accept the normal ethics and you suddenly hear that you should be selfish. You read something by Miss Wren. And let's say it makes a good case within the limits of what you read. Now you want to integrate. Let's assume. Well, how would you know where to start? You couldn't obviously just take human knowledge as a total and say, well, I'll start with astronomy, it's in the A's. And now I'll go through everything about the galaxies. And now I'll go to biology as the B's. And then I'll go to chemistry. I mean, that would be, there'd be no guidance, and it would be practically, physically impossible to do. But you'd say to yourself, egoism is what? You classify it, first of all. This is a code of values or a principle of ethics, right? So right away, it tells you you're in the realm of values, right? The first thing you want to know then is, are there any other values you hold that are connected to this that you may have missed, that you may have formed on another basis? That's the obvious connection, because this is a type of value judgment, right? So you'd have to survey things like your political values. If you're converted to egoism and you find that you love George McGovern or his equivalent, you'll begin to see there's some clash here because he's preaching the opposite, you see. I'm just giving you a pattern. And you know, as soon as you say values are moral values, are principles of how man should behave. So that's obviously connected to the nature of man, right? And if you hold a certain basic idea of how man should live and you change it, then you have to see, does that imply a very different understanding of the nature of man? After all, you were led to the idea of sacrifice by some kind of implicit view, at least, of the nature of man. Maybe you were taught all men are brutes and they have to sacrifice their desire. Now you learn that they should go after what they want. Well, you have to go back and then say, my view of man must have been wrong. Well, I was told that they have to sacrifice their desires because they're brutes. Well, what are their desires? What's the source of desire? You see what I mean? In other words, I'm just giving you the tip of the iceberg here, but by the nature of the principle itself, if you define in what category it falls, then you get the direction as to where to go to integrate it. And then what category does that depend on, you see? And then you know on the face of it that it does not make sense to look at chemistry here. If you want to look at a science, look at economics or look at history where human action and motivation is involved, because this is a principle governing what should be people's motivation. Then you can say, well, how did egoism work out in history? In the egoistic eras or the more egoistic eras, what was life like, you see? In the more altruistic or sacrificial eras. You see what I'm saying? In different economic theories or systems, how do they work out according to, you see what I mean, these principles? By the nature of the principle, for instance, egoism, you're pointed in a certain direction and then you follow the logic of what that dictates as far as you have time and strength and knowledge. But, you know, you can't do it all at once, and you won't necessarily see what somebody trained in the field would see. But that's okay, because you connect what you can. Every link you make, every time you say, oh, now I see that egoism really helps to explain history, or really helps to make sense of economics, or, you know, wherever you do make the integration, to that extent you make your own knowledge clearer, and that opens up the next day, week, month, or year when some, you know, you have a standing order. When some new lead comes in, you'll make another integration. Does that give you at least a clue as to, that's the most I can do beyond, you know, a whole course, which I'm not even prepared to give exactly at this point, I believe, but that's the best I can say is define by essentials and then follow the logic within your knowledge. And don't worry if you miss something, because it'll always be there and it'll come up. Yes, at the back.
I have two related questions. Does the statement that human knowledge is relational, does that come from the fact that entities are related? And
no, you misinterpreted me, Rick, because human knowledge is relational is which page are we there? 182. It has two roots, as I say on 183. It derives from two different facts. One, the nature of reality, and one, the nature of consciousness. One, the sheer metaphysical fact that everything is interconnected, whether we're around or not, as I was discussing in connection with the first question. And then second, the specific nature of consciousness is to grasp relationships. Now, of course, we couldn't have the second if the relationships didn't exist, but that doesn't mean we create the relationships. So that there's two sources of it. The nature of consciousness and the nature of existence in this context.
On the part where relationships exist, that's part of that meaning, do you establish as a corollary to identity or existence that relationships exist?
No, the relationships are simply determined observationally. You don't deduce the existence of relationships. Everything we do in coming to acquire knowledge, as I've said several times, is perceiving relationships. There can be no question of how do you prove that there are relationships, because all cognition is differentiation and integration, which is grasping relationships. So if you leave that up in the as something to be, quote, proved or derived, your consciousness is contentless. As soon as you start being aware, as Mr. Ryan used to say, even if you stare and a completely blue sky, as against nothing, you would not grasp it. So that relationship is not something that requires proof. It's a primary, direct, as soon as you are able to be aware, you may not be able to identify it, but the phenomenon is just two things considered together. And that we can do that, and that's there is not open to question. It's just like entity or action, you see.
Before we can grasp them?
Do relationships have to exist before we grasp them? Yes, but that doesn't mean that there isn't such a thing as a relationship which derives in part from our form of awareness. For instance, all the similar things, the commensurable things that we put together into a concept, in fact, are similar. We don't invent the similarity. We don't create the fact that they're all commensurable. But they are not, in fact, related into a group until we do it by themselves. This is back to the point that in reality there are no units, there are only things. The specific relationship of looking at a thing in relation to others as against a background and saying that this is a member of a group of similar members, that relationship we create. Now, we don't create it baselessly, causelessly, by whim. It's based on a real fact that the attributes of the concretes are the same without if you omit the measurements. But the point is, we are the ones that omit the measurements. So it's this is the whole reason of why concepts are not intrinsic, because the relationship that creates the class depends on us. But they're also not subjective, because what we do is a function of what's out there. So you're asking me, by asking me a question of the wording, mustn't the relationship exist for us to be aware of it, you're implying intrinsicism. Do you see that? You don't even know that you're doing that, but you're trying to go back to what's called the mirror view of consciousness. That is the idea that consciousness is just a passive recipient, reflection. And how can it be aware of something that, that isn't there? And that is a false paradigm of consciousness, you see. I hate to use that word. I won't use that word. It's not an accurate description, because consciousness is an active process. And in establishing relationships, therefore, it does something other than just passively reflect what's outside, which doesn't mean that it distorts what's there, you see. You got that? These questions are tricky, because the intrinsicist model is so ingrained. And of course, the whole strength of subjectivism, polemically, is power to persuade people is to, they accept the intrinsicist model. X must be there, and you just passively gaze it. Then they can't find X out there. They say, you see, it's just a myth. We just invented it. Knowledge is subjective. There's the whole history of philosophy is that oscillation. Somebody trying to save cognition by making it passive awareness, and then the other side saying, I can't find that thing that you claim is out there. I can't find the revelation, or I can't find the universal, or I can't find what's the same, or whatever they can't find. And so let's just say we invented. Or Kant said he can't find necessity. Hume can't find causality. It's always the same idea. We can't find X, therefore let's make it up. And it's always because their idea of finding is passive perceptual, just gazing out there. And the argument underlying it is what you said. Well, how could you be aware of it? It has to be there first. So, you know, it must be there, and you just gaze at it. But that simple formulation is not valid, you see. Does that clarify something? I hope so. Yes. No. When you integrate units into a concept, you have already isolated them first. The differentiation or separation precedes integration. You have to separate them via their similarities to each other as against the things around them. These tables here, these three, let's say, as against those chairs and couches and benches. There you use similarity. Now you've got the group isolated. You're focusing just on the tables. Integration is the next step. Integration is when you omit from your attention the variations among these similar things and put them literally together so you end up with only one thing, one unit. You call it table. That is the actual unit. This is literally a process of putting together, a mental process, in which now the similarities have already been grasped. So at this stage now, all you're doing is creating a new unit. And the way you do it is by getting a word to stand for these. And of course, you have to perform the measurement omission to make it possible for one word to stand for all these different things. No, integration takes place on many different levels. Integration in the broad sense is making a whole lot of parts, that's all. Putting many parts together. You can put sensations into percepts, percepts into concepts, concepts into higher concepts. Ideas integrated into a philosophic system. Any given idea integrated into knowledge as such. There's no more further definition I can give you on a generalized level than put together elements into a whole. The way of putting together depends on, are you making a percept? Are you making a concept? Are you making a theory? It's not always the same. The tool of integration, once you have conceptual tools to work with, is logic. Whenever you say this necessarily follows from this, you've made a connection, an integration, a tie-in. between your premises and your conclusion. You've made one unit. Now, for instance, here in this chapter, I integrated, I put together four different topics under one concept of the proper method, you see. I had to see something in common, see the logical connections, your reason, and the result is they're put together into a whole. But it's not as simple as when you see certain similarities. It depends what type of thing you're integrating. All right, I'd like to go now to knowledge as hierarchical, which we said nothing about much last time, and just go through a few points on this. Just call to your attention as we pass on 193, I worked out there an example of a very high-level abstraction, culture, which I think gives you a clear idea and pattern of what a higher-level concept is beyond the level of which there's any option. You break it up and then dot up into its parts and so on. And the conclusion we get from that on 194, a definite order of concept formation is necessary, with the stress on order. We begin with that which is closest to the perceptually given and move gradually away from the given. And of course, I then go on to show that that applies throughout to a child's learning, to any new discoveries human beings make. It's always not like a bungalow, to use that metaphor, but like a skyscraper, with each story resting on the preceding and so on all the way down. And then on the bottom of 195, the crucial issue here, that if every one of our conclusions and ideas could be gotten directly on its own from sense perception, so you could start with perception and get table, and start with perception and go right to culture, or right to justice, or right to the law of gravity, just the way you go right to the law of identity. If they were all the same distance from the senses, there would be no hierarchy. You would just go along having a series of perceptual experiences which you conceptualize right there. Everything would be like table. You would never have to worry about floating abstractions, because if you'd say, what do you mean by freedom? You just point, just the way you do at a table. The whole question of hierarchy, there would be no hierarchy in a case like that. But in fact, it is not true that all of our knowledge is on the immediate level of it being accessible to direct sense perception. And the crucial point is what I underscored in 195. Items differ. Item I use to cover both concept and proposition. Cognitive items differ in their distance from the perceptual level. Some things we can get directly from the senses, others not. And therefore, certain conclusions we can get to, certain concepts we can get to, only on the basis of earlier conclusions or concepts. And that's what leads to the idea of a hierarchical structure. Now, hierarchy, of course, is not originally a term out of epistemology, and I quote the actual official Oxford definition on the bottom of 195, the top of 196. A body of persons or things ranked in grades, like the hierarchy of the church or the hierarchy of the court, from the king all the way down. Now, we are taking that term over and using it in a logical sense. So I followed it, the exact same Oxford definition, but substituted epistemological content rather than royal or ecclesiastical content. So a hierarchy of knowledge means, see, it said a body of persons, but I'll make it a body of concepts and conclusions. Then it said ranked in grades or orders, well, ranked in order of logical dependence. The definition said one above another, I said a one upon another, according to each item's distance from the base of the structure. So it's the standard definition of hierarchy, but adapted to the logical material that we're discussing. I don't think I have to summarize. You can ask any of these questions of detail when we turn the floor over in a minute. But on 198, I just point out that every fact about knowledge, one way or the other, imposes an obligation of what you have to do to acquire it correctly. Knowledge is contextual. It's all part of one whole. Then you have to make it a whole. You have to integrate. Knowledge is hierarchical. It has higher and higher levels which are related to reality only through the intermediates. Then you have to bring them back to reality. You have to what? Reduce. The need of reduction. And I think that's a good paragraph there on 198 too. Tie together the two facts with the two obligations in one terse statement. And the definition of reduction on 199, identifying in logical sequence the steps that take a cognitive item back to perceptual data. And I called your attention on 200, that this reduction is essential if you're to avoid castles in the air. You know, there's floating rationalistic constructs where it's all deductive construction that has no actual foundation and doesn't relate to perceptual data. The only way that you can consider any higher level knowledge valid is if you bring it back to sense perception. And the term that Ms. Rand used on 200, sense data are the standard of objectivity. That is, if you want to determine is a conclusion objective or not, you have to be able to bring it back to sense data. If you can do that, you can show that step by step it had to go back to the observations, you have satisfied the standard. You've shown that your conclusion conforms to reality. But the senses are our only direct contact with reality, and therefore you have to come back to them. I then work it out on the example of friend. Those things are hard to do, by the way, those reductions, to figure out what all the levels are and what's a detail, what is important, which comes first, is a lot of work. It would be wonderful if someone had written like a conceptual map book, not a dictionary, but a series of pedigrees or genealogies, taking crucial concepts and just tracing on the pattern of what I did with friend, what the structure, what the roots are. If we had such a, that would be an invaluable service to mankind, to have like a dictionary of conceptual roots, because it's essential to making a concept clear. It does something that a sheer definition cannot do. It shows you the complete structure back to direct observation. Whereas the trouble with just definitions is they can be floating, you see. They themselves aren't reduced in the dictionary back down. Now, I don't know anybody that did or wants to or could do this job, but it would be a life work to take just, you know, maybe the top 200 or 300 concepts and trace their pedigree all the way down, but it would be invaluable. Anyway, I gave you my idea of a clue on this example of friends. But a friend. Now on 203, I want to stress for you this idea of the conceptual roots of a concept. Roots here, we mean the antecedent concepts or conclusions that we needed in order to reach this higher level item. And that idea is unique to Ayn Rand, as far as I know. The standard philosopher and most people take the attitude the concepts are here. How did they get here? Somehow. And then they just proceed to use them, dropping their roots, misusing them in the most egregious ways, and having no idea that there's any rules governing the use. They just jump in and start speaking. And it's because of Ayn Rand's awareness, very keen awareness, that every concept has this chain going all the way down to the earth, to the percepts, that she was able to identify the fallacy of the stolen concept because she could see. So she knew. She was the only person I ever met who actually knew, without having to sit and labor over it, the roots of her concepts. And if you asked her, she would be able to tell you in broad pattern, if it was a term she used, what it depended on logically. She maybe not have it all worked out, you know, to the nth degree of polish, but she actually could see that structure. She had acquired concepts, I guess, consciously in a way to grasp what she already knew that made possible the next stage. And the result was she could detect stolen concepts that people were using that they didn't know about because she could see that they were using a concept while denying or ignoring something on which it rested. Now, the only way you can get that skill, as far as I can know, is painstakingly go over whatever concepts you're having trouble with or are unclear and try to do. I tried to give just this example of friend as an example of the pattern and see if that helps you. Now then on 206 at the bottom, there is a new point that proof is a form of reduction. That is that there's the broad issue is reduction, and proof is what we call it when you derive a proposition from you take a proposition back through its roots to reality. But in that sense, proof is a form of reduction. The essence of the issue is the need to take higher level material back down. And now perhaps the most important paragraph, practically speaking, on 207, the first full paragraph. It is not a proof of something, even if you derive it from true premises and derive it validly, that is not a proof. Now, who can tell me why? Now, this, of course, goes counter to everything that's taught in standard logic courses. They said there's only two requirements for proof, for a complete proof of a conclusion. The premises must be true, and the inference must be valid or justified. Now, objectivism disagrees with that. You can have true premises and a valid inference, and that does not mean you prove the conclusion. And that's the thing I want to stress to you. Why does it not? No, that's a different point. And not because you have to integrate. That's a different point. I'm thinking. Yeah. Well, tell me, the reduction is just a word.
It has to reduce back down all the concepts back to perceptual. Yeah.
The purpose of proof is as a means of getting your conclusion back to sensory data. If you just take random premises that you know somehow or other are true, you and put them together accidentally in such a way that they come up to your conclusion, you still don't see how that conclusion goes back to reality. All you see is that conclusion go back to two different conceptual starting points, and you can't make the chain all the way back to reality. In that case, that is not a proof. That is just an arbitrary manipulation. Even if your conclusion follows, that isn't what relates it to reality. So to you, it's still floating. Now, I gave an example here of the funeral industry in the next paragraph, but I'll give you a more realistic example. The type of people who prove man's rights or prove the validity of capitalism by saying it promotes the public welfare. And their argument is, if something promotes the public welfare, must be good. Of course, objectivists wouldn't disagree. We don't think objectivism hurts the public welfare. If something really promotes the public welfare, it's good. That's true. And then they say rights or capitalism promote the public welfare. True enough. Therefore, they say rights or capitalism must be good. Now, that is premises which are in some sense true, leading unavoidably to a conclusion that is not a proof of capitalism or rights, as you know, because it completely bastardizes and perverts the hierarchy. It implies the first thing we come to grasp informing our conclusions or concepts is public welfare. On that basis, we then go on to find what leads to the public welfare, and then we go on to discover that rights are a requirement and that therefore the way to validate rights is to take them back to the primary, which is public welfare. Now, of course, that it builds collectivism into the whole approach. You can't start with the public, nor can you start with the floating term welfare. Those are far up derivatives, logically. How do you, in fact, have to go? You have to start with man, and we're talking the value connection. And then we have to reach values. What's good and evil for man? And how, therefore, should he act? And how, therefore, should he organize societies? That we built politics on our ethics. And then, when we observe certain codes of politics, we'll say, this one works, it has certain effects on men. Obviously, it would have to, given the nature of man and the nature of the system. So the conclusion of public welfare is a far, far later conclusion built on all the preceding. It's a consequence. It's secondary, tertiary, quaternary, whatever higher number you can come to. To make it the primary and try to derive a proof of rights or capitalism is completely to pervert the hierarchy, you see. You're not then reducing capitalism or rights back down the chain. You're taking an arbitrary starting point and trying to use that to ground things which are logically antecedent, so that there is a perversion over and above the moral capitulation to altruism. There is a logical corruption in the attempt to ground a political system on its effects on the welfare of the species. You have to logically start with a man, his nature, his requirements, and only then the type of system when they interact with others, and only then what will it be the consequences. So this is the type of thing we mean when we say it's not enough to have true premises. They must be the premises that actually take your conclusion back to reality. And if they don't, then they in turn must be conclusions from earlier premises and so on. And of course, the whole point of my struggles with organization of the sequences in this book is precisely to obey this paragraph. I don't want to just give the right material. I want to give it in the right hierarchical order wherever I can determine what that is, so that when the time comes to validate any point or to grasp its connection to reality, I can go backward through this chapter or the section or whatever and have the key elements of the hierarchy present. That was the point of starting with existence and going up and trying to explain to you at each point why something comes later and later. It's to live up to this paragraph. On the other hand, most people distrust logic and proof, and the standard thing they say is, oh, anybody can prove anything, right? You hear that all the time. Well, proof is nothing. Anybody can construct a proof of anything. Well, of course, if proof means jumping in anywhere with premises that you can't find anything wrong with, and you know, they're just out of the blue, seem okay to you, well, anybody can then prove anything, pretty much, because you can make the worst errors sound plausible in an out-of-context formulation. And then you can deduce a conclusion, and everybody claims to prove everything. And the method of attacking that is not to argue about the premises, not to tell the guy your premise is wrong. Tell the guy, the first thing you have to do is defend the choice of these as premises. Whether they're true or false is beyond the point. They have to earn the status of being premises. They have to come to merit that position by you being able to show that this is the link, the logical precondition in reality of getting to this type of conclusion. And if people even had the idea that that was a necessity, that would abort a vast number of the alleged proofs that people offer and discuss, because they would have no idea even of hierarchy or structure. So I regard this particular paragraph as being very essential, practically speaking. Did anybody, you had a question? Yeah.
What you just did was inductive, because you said man needs this, man's nature is such that this, and he needs this kind of political system. But thought the nature of reduction is to go backwards.
No, let me clarify that. Don't confuse reduction and induction. Reduction is a much broader term. Induction and deduction are two forms of inference. But both types of conclusions, whether you reach it by deduction or induction, have to be reduced. Both of those are forms of reducing a conclusion back to reality. In induction, for example, when you go from instances to a generalization, the way to get that generalization back to reality is to go back to the instances. Those are the premises. In deduction, you go back through your general principle to its instances. In both cases, you go from a conclusion, step by step, back to directly perceivable data. It's just that induction and deduction differ on the types of data. Induction starts with concretes to simplify, and deduction starts with a principle already established. But that is, from our point of view, a distinction within the broad topic of reduction. Let me see if there was one. Yes, I wanted to cover one more point before we throw it open. That's on the top of 208. Because they know that this bothers people. This idea of a double check, line 3 of 208, and saying the need to integrate and to reduce. And between the two processes, man achieves a double check on his accuracy. Every conclusion has to stand, has to be related to his other knowledge, and then step by step back to direct experience. Now, that bothers a certain type of person who feels, why do I, even if it's desirable to integrate, why do I have to integrate in order to know that my proof per se is valid? Suppose I give a real proof of something, step by step by step, therefore. And I haven't yet integrated it to anything. Can't I at least know my conclusion is valid just simply from the fact that I can take it step by step back to reality before I've done any integration? And my answer to that is, well, you can know that your conclusion is valid, but if you want the full cognitive status that we imply when we say this is certain, you must also engage in integration. The reason you need a double check is this. It is possible to give giving a proof is a complex process. It has many steps, and you can go back to something that you regard as self-evident, and you think you've taken it back to, you know, incontestable primaries, and in fact, you have erred. You've taken something as obvious, which is not really obvious. You've taken a self-evident what is simply something built into your equipment for a long time. You can think you've got an airtight proof, but if you don't integrate it, at least in broad pattern with the other things you know, there's too grave a danger that you succumb to some kind of rationalistic deduction and avoid. Now, I'm not saying with the skeptics you can never be sure you didn't make a mistake, but I'm very strongly on the idea that one crucial means that we have of avoiding errors, even errors in identifying what a proof is the bulwark of all the rest of our knowledge tying in and integrating to this conclusion. So it is necessary to give a proof, but by itself I don't regard that as definitive if you can't integrate that conclusion in some key form to the rest of your knowledge. And the history of philosophy is littered with people who give, quote, airtight proofs that simply are not airtight proofs, but they were sure they were. Even take Parmenides, who's a great philosopher. And he argued, in effect, change involves a contradiction. When a thing changes, it's the same after the change as it was before, but it's different because it's changed. But contradictions are impossible, and therefore change is an illusion. Now, this seemed to him absolutely airtight, you know. You just couldn't get away from it. Contradictions are impossible. Obviously, the thing is the same as what it was and it isn't. Therefore, this change must be simply an error. There's no such thing. There's no motion, etc. Now, if he had been, of course, it's much too early to expect it, but if he had been on the premise of integration as an epistemological necessity, it couldn't get off the ground. Because the first thing you'd have to do is say, well, if change is an illusion, what does that do to the rest of my knowledge? How does that integrate with, I'm giving an argument, I'm doing something, but you can't be doing anything if change is unreal. So that it's a clash, there's a contradiction. How does this integrate with I get up in the morning? But there is no morning and there is no getting up, etc. If he took the most elementary data available to him from every sphere, he'd see there has to be something wrong here. But if you take the idea, and all these early Greeks were rationalists, you just start from certain seemingly incontestable premises and churn out the conclusion and then say, that's it. To hell with everything else. That is, in effect, the rationalist approach, and that is, it's to counter that. You see that I'm saying you need really a double check. You don't have to be in doubt about your conclusion once you've proved it, but it doesn't enter that glorious sunlit, this is a certainty, until you've given it both processes. You have to take it back to reality, obviously. If you only connected it to other knowledge but not to reality, it would be floating. You have to reduce it, but then you must also integrate it to the main other elements so that when you think of that conclusion, you see its basis and you see that everything else you know, as far as you can trace it, ties into, supports, and confirms this. And then you have that inner grasp, that complete sweep of this is it, this is true. A little argument by itself, however sweet, is the beginning, but it is not yet enough. And that's what I'm trying to get at when I say a double check. This is another aspect of why integration is actually a means of cognition. And then the only last point in this was that incredible skeptic. That is an actual quote. I can't remember the name of the guy. I think he taught at NYU. I wrote this years ago. On 210, how can I be sure that there are rocks? Because maybe somebody has put electrodes in my brain. I mean, mentality is beyond discussion. But I put it in here as a horrid example of the rejection and reversal of hierarchy. This guy takes as his axiom, mad scientists can do fantastic things in the brain with electrodes. That's where I start. First I have sense perception, and the baby opens his eyes, and his next sentence is, what mad scientists can do when they use electrodes on a brain. And then, having learned that, he says, gee, I don't know if there are rocks, maybe the scientist is doing it to me. Now, if you ask this guy, how did he ever come around mad scientists and electrodes? His answer would be, what do you mean? I speak English. I don't need any words. I got the words. Everybody has words. Those are free to anybody. But of course, the objectivist point is they're not free. You are committed to a tremendous view of reality, of cognition, and a whole series of principles before you can speak, and certainly before you can talk about scientists and electrodes. And the idea that you just plunge in and start talking and use that elevated knowledge to deny the validity of the senses, to anyone who grasps the idea of hierarchy, that is astounding. And then on the very bottom of 211, you see now the full reason why objectivism has to be presented in a hierarchical fashion. Philosophy is hierarchical, and so therefore is objectivism. All right, let's take a break here, and then we'll have questions. All right, let's take some questions on knowledge as hierarchical. Several people have asked to have an open questions on everything to get in questions that they missed from earlier material, so we'll try to leave some time near the end for that. And I've been reminded to repeat the questions. Apparently I haven't been entirely doing that, so I'll try to remember. Who has questions now on knowledge as hierarchical? Yes.
On page 205, you discuss subject the knowledge concept.
Yes.
Concept. Do you think that such a categorization could be applied to discipline? Do you think that there are such things as invalid disciplines or?
Oh, absolutely. Is there such a thing as an invalid discipline? Now, by a discipline, we don't mean literally that they're disciplined, but you're using it just in the sense of a subject matter set aside for systematic study. Absolutely. There are whole pseudosciences devoted to non-existence. Angelology is a classic example. The medievals studied all the hierarchies of angels. They could tell you more about angels than you know about physics. In terms of amount of information, the only trouble was they couldn't reduce angelology back to perceptual observations. Certainly, with alchemy, astrology, you know, all the stuff that studied in connection with parapsychology, 98% of ecology, the part that isn't plain, you know, biological or geological observation. Nazism had entire racist subjects that are non-existent. So the existence of a, what you call a discipline, only indicates, per se, that human beings have decided to focus on something, to select something, but whether the, what they've selected is a myth or an aspect of reality, throughout every period, there's been organized study of nothing, of a non-existent. Education is becoming more and more that now. So there's not only invalid concepts, there's invalid subjects. And that's helpful when you know it, because you don't have to bother, you know, with it at all. Yes.
A moment ago, you mentioned the possibility of writing a dictionary or a genealogy of concepts.
Yes.
But to think about it for a moment, without the standards of proof, and indeed the whole philosophy you're teaching here, such a book would not be possible.
Correct. So, what's the conclusion? He says without the epistemology of objectivism, the book that I mentioned earlier on the genealogy of concepts would be impossible. True, but what's the conclusion? An objectivist has to write the book. Or somebody who understands the objectivist epistemology. That simply narrows down the authorship.
Yeah. I was making that observation.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay. Well, no, I think that's true, because if you didn't have an objective approach to concepts rather than intrinsic or subjective, you couldn't begin. Yes?
I have a question concerning the statement that the concept of hierarchy is only metaphysical, only epistemological.
Okay.
The question is, why would it be inappropriate to say that you can rank properties of matter or aspects of nature in terms of causal fundamentality? For example, physicists study elementary particles and property of interaction. From that, they can deduce the properties of atoms. From that, they can deduce material properties. So wouldn't it be proper to say that a property of an electron is hierarchical, more fundamental than electrical conductivity?
Well, that entirely, I don't want to repeat that long question, but let me synopsize it. The question amounts to this. There is such a thing as causal relationships in reality, one thing being more fundamental than and leading to another. And if that is what is involved in hierarchy, why can't you say there's a hierarchy in reality? That, in other words, that hierarchy is metaphysical and not just epistemological. And the answer is that hierarchy, as I am using the term, as I use it in epistemology, is not the same as causal connection. It's not the same as a causal relationship. It is not the same as fundamental and derivative metaphysically. hierarchy is entirely in terms of the distance from the ease of cognition, put it that way. The simplicity, how close it is to what we first are given. Now, as I had a paragraph there to indicate that to a species with different senses might very well perceive atoms first, and to them, tables and chairs would be later in the hierarchy. This is not because atoms cause tables, nor vice versa. You see, it's debatable. In a sense, you say if you could get all the way down to atoms, wouldn't that explain macroscopic objects? Well, yes, it would. Let's assume it did. But on the other hand, what we know about macroscopic objects helps us to understand what we know about atoms and subatomic particles. After all they are, we know from direct observation, we have to reduce them back. So when you talk about what would a causal explanation be, that in itself is a complex question within the philosophy of science. But that is a separate question from the order of learning something. Now, just to make the point clear, imagine an entirely different species that would have, let us say, by direct awareness, philosophic principles, and only many, many years later, chemical observations, or vice versa. The order, I can't imagine what that would be, but hierarchy pertains to, given that form of cognition, this is where it starts and this is what it's built on. It might coincide in a given case with cause and effect metaphysically, but it doesn't. There's nothing in the nature of the thing which makes it necessary. If you're going to prove causal relation, that is not the same as logical relation in terms of the order of coming to know something. That's the key point. That's a good question. Yes?
That's
a good example of why context is everything. Try to answer this question with no further context. Is it within everything's nature to change? Everything. Now, I don't know any context for that question. I'm just trying to give an epistemological sideline tip here. I don't know where, as they say, he's coming from. I don't know what he's taking for granted as conditioning that question. So by everything, does he mean everything you can conceivably distinguish? Is it possible for it to change? Well, no. Concepts don't change. 2 and 2 equals 4 doesn't change. Principles don't change. Well, he said, no, I mean just physical objects. Well, which physical objects? Subatomic particles? Well, I don't know. They move. Do they all move? I don't know. How would I know? Maybe he means the universe as a whole. Well, that doesn't change. I mean, everything out of the blue, can it change, is an unanswerable question, not because you asked a bad question, but because it doesn't carry with it the context that would lead to it. Now, you want to fill me in what considerations raise that question in your mind. That would then be the context that's conditioning it, and that'll make it possible for me to maybe answer it. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking of entities such as a rock over an extended period of time. It could become sand. So I can see that entities do change over extended periods of time. And then I was thinking of non-entities such as relationships. And I was thinking that as long as there's motion and spatial movement, that relationships change. And then I was thinking of the universe. Although the universe in total may not change, the arrangements within the universe are in constant change.
In other words, you're simply saying your mind wandered to very, or no, I don't mean wandered pejorative, your mind went to rocks and they're capable of change, and a certain relationships and they were capable of change. And you thought of something in the astronomical world and it's capable of change, so now you're just putting it together, everything is capable of change. You're just making.
I'm asking.
Yeah. No, but that is not a valid process, not a valid conclusion. The fact that you see change in connection with certain kinds of concretes, you can't simply sweep to everything because it depends, as I said earlier, what you mean by everything. There's all kinds of separable aspects, laws, principles, numbers, etc., that to which this doesn't apply. Change is a specific type of phenomenon that you observe. It's applicable in different ways to different things, but you can't just jump from rocks and clouds to everything without getting into trouble. And there would be no point to that. There would be no meaning to it unless you were going to go all the way and say Heraclitus. Now, he drew the conclusion everything is not only capable of change, it is changing. And it's changing in every respect. Yeah, that was simply the ultimate conclusion from observing that a lot of things change a lot. Everything is changing everywhere, all the time. And the result was, you can't then speak at all. And his disciple Cratylus simply stopped speaking, because as soon as he started to say the thing was gone before he could say it. So you can't generalize like that. You can't make metaphysical principles out of that. Anything else on a hierarchy? Yes, at the back. Can't hear you.
This is a question that expands on your answer a few questions ago about the relationship of epistemological hierarchy and metaphysical hierarchy.
Well, no, I would not use the term metaphysical hierarchy. I don't use the term that way. I think that's confusing.
In the sense that the questioner gave.
That was cause and effect, and I don't call that hierarchy. I don't think atoms are lower or higher than the chairs that they make up. There is no ranking in terms of order or structure. They're all, the chair is the atoms that make it up. The atoms aren't earlier or later, before or after. There's no sequence. There's no order. There's an order in our coming to learn, but there's no order in the thing itself. Even if it's true that the chair is entirely explicable in terms of the atoms, they're still simultaneous in reality. All that happens is that we study the atoms late, and then we can explain our earlier observations. That doesn't make them earlier. It doesn't make them more real. Yes.
Are there equally valid structures?
No.
Epistemological
structure
based on order.
No.
Regardless, let's say, of their particular
perception,
comes to different.
I get your question. Yeah. The question is hierarchy the same for every consciousness? It's not the same for every consciousness, but it's the same for every human consciousness. Hierarchy depends on the type of consciousness you have, what you're given first, and what you then build on. Given a certain kind of consciousness, though, you start at the same place and you have to build in order. So given a human means of perception and a human conceptual faculty, the logical hierarchy is the same. Where there are options, as precisely where hierarchy does not apply, as I say on page 197. There are many options of detail. And I give the example, you can get to organism through one sequence or through another. So that is not mandatory. But the fact is that hierarchy applies when you have a series which requires the proceeding. And if it requires it for one, it requires it for all. Now, I want to leave some time at the end. Let's look briefly at this last section. Intrinsicism and subjectivism is the two forms of rejecting objectivity. And here you see I'm taking all the topics that I covered earlier from an objectivist point of view and looking at them now from the point of view of these two opposite theories. The root, again, is their view of concept formation. I think that all pretty much speaks for itself. And then on 216 is the summary here. The intrinsicists want to obey reality, the third paragraph. But they don't know any way to do it but to project our own conceptual products out into reality. The subjectivists know that that is a senseless projection. So they say there is no way to obey reality. We choose these creations. It's our perspective, that's all. And of course, both of those are the opposite of the objective. Now, I think the best thing in that regard is the bottom of 217, where I have the three approaches to knowledge defined in parallel sentences, 1, 2, 3. And I think this is the best way to capture. Now, this, starting there with the objective approach to concepts, you see the third last paragraph from 217. This is not a definition of knowledge. The definition of knowledge comes later on page 275, grasp of fact on the basis of perception or reason. We haven't come to reason yet. This is simply a definition of what objective knowledge consists of. This is the objective view of knowledge. I'm looking at it from that one angle, objective as against intrinsic or subjective. And later we'll put it all together to make reason and therefore what the final definition of knowledge is. But the contrast of the three approaches. The objective view holds that knowledge is the grasp of an object. Well, now intrinsicism agrees with that. It too claims to be, or wants to be, reality oriented. We have to grasp an object. But now the difference there is the objective approach says the only way to grasp, we're speaking throughout on the conceptual level, is through an active process chosen by the subject. A process, of course, that's based on reality, but nevertheless something that we have to contribute that reflects our consciousness. Whereas the intrinsicist says the only way to grasp an object is deliberately not to adulterate it, in quotes, with our mental processes and our choices, but just to stand back and let the object enter your mind. And that's what becomes the passive absorption of revelations. Now, you won't be surprised to know that intrinsicists are characteristically determinists. Why? Can you guess why? Yes. Because no volition is required for conceptual knowledge. They think their conceptual level is automatic. They just have to open and receive what's given. It's like the perceptual level. Their experience or view of the conceptual level is just like ours of the perceptual. It just is something streaming in from the outside. So there is no longer room for volition. Now, for religious reasons, some of them advocate a form of free will, but the theory as such leads to full-fledged determinism, human passivity, man as completely automatic robot just receiving the imprint of the beyond. Now, subjectivism, the bottom sentence there, stresses with us the need of mental activity, that passivity is not enough. Subjectivists characteristically accept free will. They believe in volition. Why are they able to? Because they have rejected reality. So they feel there's no tyrant telling us what we have to do anymore. Reality is out of the way. So we're free to do whatever we want. That's the substance of 20th century philosophy. Our consciousness is free to make anything the way it wants because there's nothing here but our consciousness. All the rest is malleable. So if you talk to a subjectivist the right way, he'll sound like a good, he strongly believes in mental activity, he scorns the idea of being passive, he believes in free will. The only gimmick or difference is that he doesn't believe that you grasp objects. There are no objects that he's concerned about out there. He simply creates, or society if it's a group version, creates the things that he claims to know. And so the point that knowledge is the creation of an object, not the grasp. Now, you see, each of them have something right and something grossly wrong. The intrinsicists are right to stress the grasp of reality. The subjectivists are right to stress the role of mental activity, process, human choice, the contribution that man makes. But, of course, they're each crucially wrong by omitting that other element. Now, objectivism is the only one that puts those two correct elements together when you grasp an object through this type of process. And I think that gives you, in one little section of a page there, the formula for the whole thing. Now then, I just go on to show that really for an intrinsicist or a subjectivist, starting at the bottom of 221, all these later developments like logic, proof, integration, reduction, are really stolen concepts to a subjectivist or an intrinsicist. If they followed consistently the logic, the development of their own viewpoint, they would never feel the need of such a thing as logic, reduction, proof, integration. It just wouldn't come up because it's just revelations from beyond or arbitrary whims from within. But of course, given that there's Aristotle and the science that followed in his wake, they feel the need to recognize such a thing as logic, but it's simply something parroted and then distorted in accordance with their own views. And that's where you get these modern, or rather the corrupt theories of logic, logic as playing with linguistic castles or playing with rationalistic innate ideas and so on, rather than logic as non-contradictory identification being reduced back to sensory data. And now here is a new point of my own here, that it is that default on so broad a scale that is what gave rise to the idea that something can be good in theory and not work in practice. And I explain, I think you must already understand this, on 223, no objectivist, no one who knew the objectivist epistemology could dream of such an idea. Because if theory means the integrated grasp with all the elements reduced back to reality, how can it not work? What is there left to overthrow or interrupt it? But if you don't have a valid epistemology, a valid method of cognition, then your conclusions will characteristically clash with reality. On this intrinsicist or subjectivist viewpoint, when you think, when you use the conceptual level, that's one world. Whether they call it Plato's forms, or Kant's categories, or modern constructs, it's a separate world of floating concepts. That's what they think about. When they engage in practice, when they act, that's a different world. That's the world of percepts. The world of concretes, of physical things, of sense objects, whatever term they use. And since they have these two worlds, since they've reached percepts and concepts, since concepts to them are not integrations of percepts, the result is they have no way to deal with ideas, to apply them in practice. And ideas, as I say, are inherently schizophrenic. They work in one world, but not in the other. And they all of them have two worlds, Plato's world of forms in this world, Kant's noumenal world and the phenomenal world, in one way or another. Hegel's absolute as it really is, when it's completed its career, versus the absolute in its lower phases as we observe it around us, etc. And this dichotomy ultimately stems from the failure to connect percepts and concepts. And that means it goes back to a false theory of concepts. This is, I think, is explained on 224, that the how this all ties into the mind-body dichotomy. We said in the chapter one that if you reject reality, I'm simplifying here, then you'll come in constant conflict with it. And so you'll have the feeling that there's a dichotomy. It's the inner versus the outer, mind versus body. But now what we're adding in the next paragraph is that mankind can't depart from reality on the perceptual level. It can only do so on the conceptual level. And of course, any given error by an individual may be innocent. But when you have a whole civilization bewailing the untrustworthiness of the conceptual level, and it's split from the perceptual level, that has to be not the result of any individual error, but an assault on the mind as such, on the very nature of concepts. And so I conclude that the deepest source of the mind-body dichotomy comes from a false view of the mind, in other words, a false view of concepts. And the only way around it is to come back to the fact that, come back to the axioms. Existence and consciousness together is the necessary elements to grasp what the true conceptual level is. And if we follow that out all the way, we'll get rid of both of these false approaches and thereby wipe out the whole mind-body dichotomy, including all its variants, including theory versus practice. Okay, that is basically what I wanted to say, and I think in the remaining time I will have questions, first of all, anywhere on this chapter, from this section, or anywhere else. Yes, in this chapter, here.
Ayn Rand mentions four schools: realism, moderate realism, nominalism, and conceptualism.
Conceptualism, yes.
Would you comment on conceptualism and specifically why the objectivist theory is not conceptualism?
Well, conceptualism is a very vague theory. As far as I know, it had some currency in the 16th, 17th century. It was a step between Aristotle and nominalism. It was really just a transition. It was the idea that there are abstract concepts as against the idea that there are merely images, and that those concepts in some way are related to concretes rather than to Platonic other world. But the problem, the reason it never lasted, they never could say how the concepts were related. Now, if you want to say, yes, there are abstractions, and yes, they relate to concretes, great. But that is not a theory yet. The whole trick of the theory of concept formation is, how do you get these abstractions, and specifically, what do they denote in reality? And that's, the conceptualists had no clue to it. So what they were historically, I didn't even bother to mention them here, is simply a transition from the realism of the medieval period to modern nominalism. So they gave up intrinsic foundation of concepts, but they couldn't supply any other metaphysical basis. And so they led directly, they contributed to the triumph of nominalism. But I, from my point of view, I regard that as a detail. Yes?
Page 225, last sentence.
You say in some century yet to come, perhaps, this approach will lead to another renaissance. Why?
Which is why?
Why do you say in a century yet to come, and why do you say perhaps?
Well, I can certainly tell you, the question is the bottom sentence of 225. I say in some century yet to come, perhaps this approach will lead to another renaissance. Why do I say some century yet to come? Well, it's a dead certainty, since it's now 1990, that it's not coming in this one. If you take into account the amount of time that's required to disseminate a new philosophy in the midst of, you know, the world the way it is now, you're talking about much longer than any of us are alive. It's certainly not something that you're going to see in the next 10, 20, or 40, or 80 years if you're talking about a really serious, you know, spread, because there's so much going so fast and there's so much you have to challenge, and the system as it stands preempts the minds of the young so that only a rare few can break through. Their intellectual curiosity is atrophied, or they're so fraught and propagandized, indoctrinated with corrupt ideas, that by the time they start to go into philosophy, they're lost. They just can't think their way out of it. The better ones run like the plague from philosophy. I know a very intelligent man, not at all an objectivist. very creative, artistic, who says flatly that he hates abstractions. And that's an unarguable point with him, because it's indissoluble in his mind that abstraction is all that junk that's taught in school that makes no sense, that has nothing to do with life. And that's unfortunately what happens to the best people. Whereas the kind that see what's going on in school and say, oh yeah, I like this, is bad news. So there's only the rare ones, and that's a tremendous load that they have to carry, because first of all, they have to go through the process of learning the approach themselves. That's as to why it's some century yet to come. Now, why do I say perhaps? I don't know. I have to, if I left the perhaps out, I grant you there's a definite element of, what would you call it, pessimism, not to say bitterness, in that perhaps, but if you left it out, it would be in some century yet to come, this approach will lead. Well, how do I know? I don't. I have no way of knowing what's going to happen in centuries yet to come. Maybe, I mean, as far as I know, the human race will be annihilated or will move to another planet or mutate. I can't make predictions here. Definitely, this is what's going to happen in 15 centuries. And there's just too many unknowns to make such a claim. All I can say is, it would be nice if it happens. We're farther advanced, thanks to Ayn Rand, than we would have been. If she hadn't existed, then I wouldn't even say maybe. Then I would say, who could even say that someday it'll get better, because we don't know where we are. We're completely lost. But at least I think what her achievement was to show us that it's possible to get on the right track, to reorganize society, to know what to do. It can happen, which I wouldn't have said before I knew her ideas, because I wouldn't have known how to reorganize, what was right, how to think, etc. But, you know, you can't work a miracle. And what's to come in the future is not predictable at this stage. So I have to say, maybe. Is that answering? Okay. I mean, if you have inside information, I would be happy to hear it. Yeah.
Would it be proper to think of deduction as a sub-process of reduction, and that you're going from generals to particulars?
Yes. All forms of reasoning, deduction and induction, are forms of reduction. Yes. I covered that earlier. Maybe you didn't hear that. All right, yeah. 205. Of which? Invalid concepts, yes.
Could you bring them up at this point and show us that how you determine the valid concepts in school?
In order what?
You bring up the
valid
concepts at this point to show that how we determine the valid concepts is through the process of reduction.
Yes, I brought up invalid concepts at this point precisely because it's a further illumination of the need of reduction. The essence of an invalid concept is one that you cannot take back to perceptual data. It's either a myth, an equivocation, whatever. You can't go back to something you perceived in reality and say, this is the steps by which I got to this concept. And therefore, I thought if we're discussing reduction, this is a helpful aspect to see what's wrong with these invalid concepts. You see, it's not the fact that the referent is unobservable, because a lot of scientific concepts, the reference can't be observed. But it's the fact that you can't get back by any means to the perceptual level, whereas a truly scientific concept, he has to be able to get, ultimately point to the facts, the experiments that he observed that led him through a certain chain to this conclusion. Now, I want to try once more for a couple of minutes to give the floor to the silent people, because we did very well the first time around with that. So I'm going to amend it this way. If you have asked only one question or less throughout the course, this is now 16 hours, I will open it wide to anything on the first four chapters But that means you've asked only one or none for, let's give them some chance. Gary, have you never asked? All right, go ahead, I'll take your word. I'm not going to quiz you. Go ahead.
With respect to Dr. Vinker's question, I can see where it wouldn't be necessary to integrate your definition of egoism with some conclusions in biology and physics. However, there is a point that ultimately all your knowledge must be integrated. Mm-hmm. So would it be proper to say that in pattern, once your knowledge, in philosophy has been integrated, you would hold it as a unit, and then after that point, it is then integratable with your knowledge, say, in biology and physics?
Well, I see what you're getting at. I wouldn't put it exactly that way. Since all knowledge he's asking has to be integrated, why is it that you can't connect egoism to chemistry or egoism to directly to biology? The answer to that is we don't know enough to do that. Ultimately, there will be interconnections that we will discover, and we have aspects of them now. For instance, you can certainly see certain connections between biology and egoism. You mentioned that example. Not that the term applies, but that there's an underlying self-sustaining action which characterizes biological organisms, which is related to the chosen self-sustenance, which is egoism. So in that sense, there is a tie-in to biology through the fact that egoism is a proper function for a rational living being, and living beings takes you into biology. Now, the reason that you can't, however, I don't think it's just the amount of knowledge that we have. The way I would put it exactly is this. You can't go from any point in one theory to any point in another theory or science because knowledge has a structure and because it's specialized. Therefore, you can only interconnect through the appropriate fundamentals. For instance, is there a connection, just to take it in pattern, between ethics and biology? Yes. The nature of a living organism. That is a central link on which you're going to thread a great deal of information and integrate. Is there a connection between biology and chemistry? Obviously, there is a connection. Don't ask me to elaborate on it, but a living organism has various physical chemical processes, and you can't, in studying one, learning about the other, and obviously there's an interconnection. Is there a connection between chemistry and physics? Obviously, chemistry is a derivative of physics. Is there a connection between physics and philosophy? Obviously, metaphysics tells us the nature of reality, and we have to both have that view to get to physics and then relate our physics back to that. If the physicists come up with, for instance, indeterminacy, then you have to integrate that to metaphysics and say it's invalid. So there are all kinds of connections, but you have to reach them through the appropriate, the interconnecting link. What you cannot do is say, take one conclusion out of a complex hierarchy in one subject, and one conclusion out of a complex structure in another subject, and plug in across connector, because it doesn't necessarily follow. The connection may be between one large body of data and another large body of data, or between the foundation of one and the foundation of another, or between a particular conclusion of one and the whole approach to another. You see, what you connect depends on the actual content that you're connecting. You can't just say, well, for instance, objectivism believes in private roads, and Newton discovered the law of gravity. What's the connection? We have to integrate? Well, let me see. Maybe Newton was standing on a private road. It would be senseless to try that kind of arbitrary juxtaposition. You have to stay within the logic of the subject and connect according to essentials of the appropriate categories. But beyond that, I can't tell you, you need a whole science of integration which would require that you have a tremendous lot of knowledge to, before you could then abstract in more detail how to do it. Now, we're still following this rule of one or nothing. Yeah. I remember you asked one, so...
You said that even if you have some ironclad reduction serving as a proof, you need to do some integration, say, by way of double-checking. Could that statement be made even stronger in the sense that your proof and your premises and conclusions aren't even valid unless they're contextually specified?
Yes, I think you're correct. Ultimately, he's saying, can you go even stronger than saying what I did, that integration is a necessary supplement to reduction. He's really making a valid point because he says when you give a proof, your premises have to be contextually specified, which means you have to bring in the whole context that makes those premises themselves valid. And the bringing in of that context is a process of relating those premises to the rest of what you know. And therefore, in fact, I even say that somewhere, so that's a very good, excellent connection on your part. In the next chapter, I say, you shouldn't have to say that this is an absolute contextually when you prove something, because proof is a process of relating it to a context. So in that sense of the term, inherent in reduction is integration. But I was thinking even in a broader sense, even jumping to completely different fields as and when you can, you see, not just the immediately surrounding material, but the bigger the jumps you can make, the more dramatic the integrations, the more substance you give to your conclusion. And that's why you should not merely look at the surrounding context, but wherever there's a basis, wherever you see some clue of a direction, try to jump and see, can it be strengthened or weakened by looking in this direction or that or the other? But what you say as far as it goes is absolutely right. All right, yes?
I'm wondering how a child gets from the point where the world is sort of a chaos of concrete to the point where suddenly it can omit measurements and sort of organize these things.
Well, I don't know what I can say about that beyond what we've said. How does a child get from the preliminary chaos to the conceptual measurement omitting level? He has to do it in stages across time. And the key points, we've already said, the first part is done automatically, the integration of sensations to percepts. Thereafter, after maybe a little boost, leg up to the early concepts, has to be done by choice, perceiving similarities, classifying, with a lot of help from the adults who give you a vocabulary. That's basically all I could say, because beyond that, you'd have to go into physiology, which is, you know, the counterpart, the growth of the brain, but that's not within the realm of philosophy, but that's necessary for the child to learn. All right, let's just open it for the last few minutes to anybody on anything. Of the first four chapters. Yes?
What is the criteria for choosing the genus of a definition? For example, why is man a rational animal, not a rational primate?
Well, I thought I'd cover that. Why is man a rational animal, not a rational primate? I went in the other direction in the class, I guess, and said, why can't you say man is a rational solid? Now, you want to go in the narrower direction. And the answer, in fact, that exact example is discussed by Ms. Rand in the Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology workshops. She was asked that literal question. So I'll just repeat what she said. It is all right for a scientist to do that given his specialized context. That would not be, however, an appropriate definition for a philosopher or a philosophic study of man. Because a philosophic study of man, philosophy, and you know man, of course, is an absolutely indispensable concept to philosophy. Philosophy deals only with that information which is accessible to all human beings at all periods without the need of specialized study. That's a precondition of it being philosophy, and that's why it makes it possible for philosophy to be the base of the sciences. So as soon as you build into a philosophic concept as something that is specialized scientific discovery, you have vitiated its philosophic character. for philosophic purposes, therefore, we have to confine ourselves to the kind of observations that does not involve specialized biological distinctions. That's why we simply grasp the way a child does. Animals, but with a certain capacity. Now, there is not to say that when you become a scientist and a biologist and you want to distinguish various types of organisms, and you distinguish primates from others, that's okay. You can think of it that way, but in so doing, you're holding a highly specialized context. And that's precisely what we don't want and can't do in philosophy. So that it depends on your function. Read her answer, she covers that exact thing. Yes, Kathy.
Sorry, comment on language in chapter 4. Since languages arise in a cultural context.
Which comment on language in chapter 4?
Page 170.
1 second. The synonyms, yeah. Okay.
Since languages arise in a cultural context, can they be evaluated conceptually? Could English, for example, be a better language conceptually than Russian or Chinese?
Well, let me answer the question this way. Can languages, is the question, be better or worse? Can they be evaluated by a conceptual standard, epistemological standard? Well, let me answer this way. First of all, they can certainly be evaluated in terms of literary standards. Certain languages permit an economy or a directness or have an abundance of highly graphic synonyms that others don't have. Don't ask me which, but I know in general that this is true. That you can see in the logic of it that some languages would take fewer units to say what others take more, do it more graphically, more emotively, and so on. So literarily, there's definitely differences. Epistemologically, so far as I know, if you are not talking about primitive languages, if you're talking about the language of a developed Western or civilization, or even Eastern, everything we can think, they can think. It's simply a question of the form of notation, which may be better or worse, more convenient or not. The crucial difference is also that some languages don't have certain concepts that others do. But that is a dearth of their vocabulary, which you could theoretically inject a new concept into that language. If the language in and of itself were to be defective, over and above simply omitting certain concepts, which is possible, of course, in any language, that would mean that the actual structure of putting the concepts together was either so primitive or so defective that you couldn't think certain thoughts in that language. Now, I do believe that's true of primitive languages, that they're built in such a way that you can't integrate or differentiate in certain forms within that language. They simply are blocked. And that is certainly obviously inadequate, but I don't believe that applies to French or German or Russian or anything that we are familiar with. The very fact that you can write a novel in one of these and translate it and get the content of it from the other, and that we can all interchangeably discuss at international conferences, physics and chemistry, etc., is the evidence that whatever the differences or advantages, it's not as cognitive tools that modern languages differ. I think we have room for one more. Who's the last one? Linda. Yeah.
About what you mentioned, the question before that, about that philosophy has to start from the evidence that's available to everyone.
Right.
And you said one reason for this is because otherwise philosophy couldn't be the base of all our knowledge.
Well, that's one concept, yeah.
Is there also a point that it couldn't serve its integrating function if you were to, once you reached a higher level of knowledge, bring that back into your philosophical definition?
I think that's a point to that, Linda, is saying if you imported specialized knowledge into philosophy, you would lose, I'm rewording what you said, you would lose its broad generality, and consequently you would lose its ability to keep the forest apart from the trees. The whole thing of philosophy is it gives us the totality, the overview. Therefore, you do not want to import biological distinctions or chemical distinctions or physical distinctions over and above the fact that that's specialized. It would inhibit your mind in using the concepts with the requisite generality to get the integrated overview. It would be as though you're standing back trying to look at a forest and somebody keeps poking a tree up in front of you and saying, look at this one. You say, okay, I mean, there are people who specialize in looking at this one, but I'm trying deliberately to stand back and you keep poking me in the eye with this tree, you see. And so if that's what you intended, that's correct. Philosophy has to have the broad generality of being able to stand back and see the total. Now, it can't be a floating abstraction. You have to be able to concretize your abstractions, but you don't import into philosophic definitions the data from individual sciences. That's why it would be a huge mistake, for instance, to say, I mean, more than a mistake, it would be a disaster to say, well, we're way beyond existence now. We now know from Einstein and so on that existence consists of pulsars, having a convention in the latest, nearest galaxy. So instead of saying existence, we'll say the pulsar realm. Now that would be a disaster, because the whole point of philosophy is to have, in this regard, is to have a concept that covers everything without yet telling you what it is, you see. It is all we have to say, you see. As soon as you go into the details of what it is, you've lost that perspective. And the same thing exactly is true of man. You want to know what it is enough to distinguish it. But as soon as you go into it, he's a primate or his chemical structure or whatever, you've lost what you need to be able to, it's like you're loading your mind with too many units, you see, and you destroy the unity you're trying to get. That's a good observation, and with that, we will conclude for today. Thank you very much.